Hey, welcome to the Meat House, and thanks for listening to episode 224. I'm Jeff. With me tonight, we have John Jacob from our 2021 IRON-B. He was the second place winner. This is a second try at that recording. We had some technical difficulties. That's part of the headaches of just getting back into the routine of this, I guess. And anyway, he was kind enough to come and try this again for me. I really appreciate that. Hey, thank you guys at home for listening to the Meat House podcast. You can find us everywhere. We're on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Amazon Music. There's a whole list over on our website, www.themeathouse.com. You can check it out right there. And hey, before we get going any further, I also need to thank our key holders because they're the ones that are keeping the Meat House podcast free. You too can join up and get some great benefits like key holder only content, prizes, things like that. Just go to patreon.com and search for the Meat House or follow the link in the show notes. Let's get into the what are we drinking. I have two in front of me in Meat House fashion. One of them is a commercial. This is Come As You Are. This is a small batch barrel project from Sap House. This is a maple blossom honey, which is a unique varietal that I didn't even think was really available. And it's been aged for, it looks like, 8 months in a brandy barrel. I'm getting a lot of the kind of that honey sweetness and some floral on the nose. Definitely, like, for lack of a better term, some brandy character. The brandy also comes through nicely right at the mid palate. It's got a kind of not really a sweet character, but that perception of sweetness, if that tracks. And a nice kind of tannic mouthfeel. It kind of just makes your mouth feel a little like full and slick, but in a good way. I know that sounds odd. Yeah, no, I'm just consistently impressed with the barrel project from Sap House. I will happily jump into any of these anytime I get one available to me. And then in my second glass, I have one from our guest. This is the last little bit of his 2001 second place entry winner for the Meat House 2021. That probably came out sounding awkward. Sorry about that. Like I said, this is a second attempt at recording. I already opened this and drank part of it during that first attempt. What I've got left is the last probably, this looks like about 2, 3 ounces. It's definitely got a lot of like that passion flower on the nose. It almost has a kind of a licoricey character to it now that I'm smelling it here. Tasting it, it's dry, very dry, and it has a kind of a the blueberry character right now tastes a bit subdued. And like I said, this is the last little remaining bit. I recapped the last maybe quarter of a bottle after our first recording to, save for another time, and wound up needing it. So this was the first time I drank it, and when it was judged in competition, very carbonated. It's fairly flat now. I enjoyed the carbonation rather a lot. The blueberry tastes a little bit more subdued. The passion flower actually tastes a little stronger, and it has a kind of a, like I said, it's almost like a fennel or a an almost a like a light licoricey character to it. That's really odd. Not necessarily what I would call like an aftertaste, but it's certainly an interesting like little flavor component to it that I don't remember getting the last time I tried this. So before we get into all the fine detail on this recipe, John, what's in your glass tonight?
Well, I am going to crack open the very same brew. I haven't had any since last year, so I'm really curious to see how if time's been kind to it or not.
Perfect.
Sounds very carbonated. It's pouring with a nice little head up to it, dissipating rather quickly.
Those meats are want to do.
Still lovely. And then for my second one, I haven't decided if I'm going to try a sister to this one, which was not a blend like this one was, or one I call Tiny Pear. It's one we made a couple years ago with these, what I could best describe as the pear version of a crab apple.
Huh. You know, it makes sense that there would be such a thing, but I've never heard of the pear equivalent of a crab apple. I may have to pick your brain on that one a little later.
I've never heard of them either, but they're definitely not. They taste like pears, and they're real hard, but they're not. They're definitely not crab apples. I use those all the time, and they're wildly different.
I can imagine.
It's just a feral tree on the way into one of my bee yards that we pick it anytime it's got a good fruit load on it.
Well, that's very cool. It's nice to be able to forage stuff from the areas you're working around and get something that's tasty out of it too. So let's get into the competition. This passion flower was a really odd ingredient choice. And I've said this with every guest. I'll probably say this with every guest remaining. But it was definitely a bit of a challenge. What were your initial reactions, thoughts when you got the secret ingredient?
Well, I actually knew absolutely zero about it. So I did a little reading and was fascinated by the medicinal uses. And to get to know it a little bit, one night before bed, I made my wife and I each a cup of tea out of what you guys sent. And then I looked up some stuff. I think in the flavor Bible, it described it as earthy and bitter, which is kind of a difficult flavor to work with. But I thought maybe I could get some tannic qualities out of it. We ended up using all of it, except for the two little 1 ounce portions we took out for tea that night in the brew, actually.
There you go. Okay. And that is, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say that how we used it was we made a tincture with some fancy pineapple vodka. It wasn't pineapple flavor. That was just the source of sugar for the yeast. And let the tincture sit in my queen bee incubator at 94 degrees for 2.5, 3 weeks or something like that. And seemed to pull all the flavor and everything we needed out of it.
Now, with that 4 ounce portion or whatever was left of 4 ounces, I think it was 4 ounces. I could be wrong. How much of the pineapple vodka did you use that base in to make your tincture?
Oh, I would say it was probably took about 1,000 milliliters altogether.
Okay.
So, I had to put it in two jars. Two quart jars.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, did you use all of that tincture? Or how sparingly did you apply it to the finished product?
I used it all. I was a little worried about therapeutic dosages and whatnot, but then I did a little bit of rough math and it seemed like stretched out over 5 gallons. And the batch, the way the brew went is, I got 100 pounds of organic blueberries from a farm that we pollinate. And when we pressed them, and that's another little side story, but it resulted in enough to fill 2 7.5 gallon fermenters, AKA 15 gallons total. And after secondary, when we went to rack, obviously I could get, and those 2 7.5 gallons, I did one yeast in one. I used the Lutra, and then I used the Pog from Imperial Yeast in the other. So I got 5 gallons each of those. And then obviously for the third keg, I had to blend the two. And since it was already a blend and kind of off the books mead there, I figured that one I was feeling the most experimental with. So we added all the tincture to that one.
Nice. So yeah, let's rewind a little bit and talk about the blueberries, because I actually going to be working with some blueberries here in the next week or so for one of my latest project needs. So it seems like a good time to talk about the difficulty of pressing those.
Yeah, I mean, where I've had the most luck generally or fun or whatever, I'm a big fan of waterless meats. So when we get apples or pears or whatever fruit we get into, we press them all, and I use the juice instead of water in all my recipes. And since I had 100 pounds of berries, I thought, let's try a waterless blueberry meat. And we macerated them in a little stainless steel garbage disposal setup thing I got just for grinding up small fruits. Mm-hmm. And it came out pretty thick, and I think we ended up with like 3 5-gallon buckets of this pulp. And my idea was just use my normal screw press. We throw it in either a pillowcase or a fruit bag and press it on down. And after blowing out 3, 4, 5 bags, trying different meshes, we had to give up on it. We could not press it. It was kind of like by the time I gave up and had dumped the bucket into the fruit sack to go into the fermenter, it looked like a giant loaf of like the canned cranberry. You know, it was just a big gelatinous mess.
Oh,
and I ended up having to add a little water to it, obviously, but probably less than any recipe I've ever read. And what got us through, what saved us, was the use of enzymes. I used some pectic enzyme and some lalazyme.
And do you remember which lalazyme you were using there?
I don't. I think it was the EX. I think it was the one for red, red wine or red pigmented fruits. And it did an amazing job, because by the time the primary was over, when I pulled that sack out, instead of being like a 5-gallon mass, it was about the size of a, by the time we squeezed it down, maybe a cantaloupe.
Nice.
And one thing I think that really that I learned is everybody knows fermenting on the skins has all sorts of benefits, but had I got to do it my way, I wouldn't have fermented on the skins. But I'm going to get 200 pounds of berries when they're ripe here later this summer. And I'm going to do my best to see if I can repeat.
That'll be great. Yeah, no, I think one of the nice things about using the Lalazyme EX that you were using there, it's definitely getting to incorporate like the tannic values and the coloration you'll get from the skins. I know a lot of blueberries, if you like open them up, so to speak, like the flesh inside that you'd be squeezing or juicing is actually pretty light colored. It's almost like a straw yellow, as opposed to the color of the skin. So especially in the case of blueberries, it's generally really, beneficial to let the skins kind of hang out and let the yeast do their like the biotransformations or they're you know, getting their teeth into it, so to speak.
Yeah, and one thing we did in secondary for a little extra berry punch is I had saved aside about a gallon freezer bag of blueberries and a gallon of frozen blackberries in the secondary.
Nice. It's always nice to throw something a little extra into secondary for a little bit more of a fresh fruit flavor. I've found that's pretty effective.
Yeah, it seemed to work. It's very, I'm definitely getting great berry notes on it right now.
So on the topic of yeast, you said you're using 2 different yeasts for this one. Effectively, you had a 7.5-gallon batch that you were fermenting on Lutra, which, if I remember right, that's the very clean fermenting Kvike strain. And then you had a Pog strain from Imperial, you said.
That's another Kvike strain. They're both Kvikes. Thanks to you guys, I'm absolutely in love with Kvikes. Well, and there's a couple guys in our homebrew club that love them too, but I just love how they work, how fast they work. I mean,
any other competing microbe in there doesn't stand a chance. They go so fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They, Fike is such a game changer for the homebrew industry that it's, you know, ridiculous. I remember the first couple times I played with it and went, wow, this is, I was literally just standing in my little brew room stunned.
Yeah, the only hard thing about them, like, we're going to have a 106 degree day tomorrow, so perfect temperatures for working with Quake. But in the wintertime, I have had to learn some crafty ways to apply a little heat to them to keep them where they're happy. I mean, I know they can go at a broad range, but we've been having really good luck about 94 to 96 degrees.
And that seems to be kind of a sweet spot for getting a lot of the, especially the, like the Voss and the ones that throw more tropical fruit characters or orangey character or, you know, what have you. That seems to be the spot you want to keep it at. And while I've not played with Lutra myself, I know, you know, obviously anything fermenting at 95 degrees is going to keep fermenting pretty fast.
Yeah, so, it finished out around 10:04, which I was pretty happy with. At first, I was worried it was going to be a little too sweet because I was shooting for dried at maybe just off dried a teeny bit.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think if it had gone a little sweeter, it would have been to the mead's detriment. I like it as a dry mead, and I recall, you know, when I had it fresh out of the bottle last time, it presented nicely in a, it struck me as very different than the other meads that I've tried in the competition so far, whereas I think a lot of people tried to balance a kind of a sweetness or fruitiness with the earthy flavors of the passion flower. I feel like you, more than any of the other competitors, really let it stand on its own and tried to not necessarily like balance it or let it play second fiddle, but had stuff that just kind of worked nicely together and let it, you know, that propped it up more than took a back seat to it.
Yeah, I kind of felt that way too. Like when I tasted it, and I can't remember if the flavor bible said something about blueberries or a good pairing or not, but I just felt, so when I received it, I felt so lucky that I had what I had in secondary already. I was like, I think this is actually going to work. I mean, a little bit of that's just dumb luck, not skill, but it definitely worked out.
Yeah, the party mead that I was planning on making and never actually got around to using some of this passion flower myself, I was actually thinking of doing something in the neighborhood of like a cherry limeade, some cherry and some lime, because that's what I happened to have in my fridge when I was playing with it initially too. You know, I made some tea and I had some like cherry juice concentrate and some, you know, some of that, the sweet lime mixer you use for different cocktails and things like that. So, I just kind of tipped some of those into my teacup and said, hey, this is actually working really nice. But yeah, it is very complimentary to fruit, and I'm not surprised in the slightest that a lot of our entries kind of leaned on fruit for the other flavor components. But yeah, no, as I said, I think yours is really letting the secret ingredient kind of stand on its own in a way that a lot of the other entries, at least the ones that I've tasted, weren't necessarily doing.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much the variety of blueberry plays into it. This farm, Looking Glass Organic Farms, they grow about 550 acres and I think 6 or 7 varieties. And when I was discussing what berries I should get with the operator, what I asked for, and I'm pretty sure that's what I got, but I told him I just want something of all your varieties. I care less about sweetness and more about the nose, like which of your berries has the best nose. And he suggested one called, its name is actually Blue Ribbon. So that's the variety we used.
Nice.
find it just a simple wildflower honey that we make.
And this is from your bees themselves, right?
Oh, yes.
Nice. Very nice.
I would only ever buy honey if it were some precious, rare variety that I had to have from my collection or something. But we got honey coming out our ears around here.
That is the nice thing about being a beekeeper, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm actually feeling a little bit inspired to do more fermenting with our honey, and thankful that we're coming into the queen breeding season, starting to wind up, and I've already gone up and taken stock of my little brewery and to see what things I need to replenish to get going again. I think we're going to warm up with a braggot here real soon, and that'll probably hold us till the tree fruits start getting ripe.
There you go. What kind of braggots are you interested in making there?
I have a real simple go-to. It's become like a standard around here. It's in part because it's delicious, in part because it's very easy, and it keeps people out of my fancy organic berry stash. Like, you'd be surprised once word gets out how fast 15 gallons can disappear. Like, it blew my mind. Like, I had to hide the rest of it to even have this one to drink today. But I call it a 3-2-1 braggot. I use three parts honey, two parts Pilsner malt extract, and then we do some hops on the hot side in the front end, and then a dry hop in the secondary with usually Citra hops in the secondary. And you cannot in the primary.
Oh, and those are some good choices. Yeah,
I was intrigued by what you guys were teaching about braggots, but part of my mission as a mead maker is to help create a value-added product, not only for the honey but for the fruit growers too. So anything with grain I wasn't that interested in, but being a hop head myself and a lover of IPAs and having worked during college at a brewery, I couldn't help myself but to try it. And plus, I noticed when you use any amount of grain, it seems to help with head retention a bit.
Mm-hmm. Some of those proteins get to hang out and keep a little lattice work on the top of the glass for that head retention. Yeah, you're right.
And we just fell in love with it. I mean, our basic recipe comes out usually between 8% and 9%. And when you taste it, you think you're drinking a 4%. So it's a little dangerous, but if everything's cleaned and sanitized before you start, I mean, you're done in under an hour, and with the Kvikes, 3 days later, 4 days later.
Yeah. Fermentation is, it's not.
Yeah. So in a pinch, like, I had a very limited time in January this year, and we were heading down to the almond pollination in California, and we have a crew of, at times it was 5 or 6 guys, basically living down there. And, I like to feed the crew, and, buying a 6-pack of beer at the end of the day for 6 guys doesn't go very far.
Yeah, it's over pretty quick, isn't it?
So I brewed a 15-gallon batch in a little homemade fermenter, and let's just say it was excellent for team morale.
15 gallons spread around 6 guys. I'm sure that was either really great for team morale for a short period of time, or really good over a long period of time. Yeah.
Oh, we shared a plenty with our growers and whatnot, but we were pretty much live about 8 hours from home from January, February, and most of March. So basically a 5-gallon keg per month. That's how that broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And we left with we left California with no, that's how we knew it was time to go home.
Booze has run out. It's time to get out of here. So how are the bees doing this year? You are a beekeeper by trade. You're probably closer to the star raw product of mead than a lot of our listeners are that are, you know, buying at a, you know, big box store or supermarket or from their local beekeeper. How are your bees doing?
How's the season? They're doing pretty good. I mean, interestingly, you know, the annual average colony loss rate, if you aggregate between hobbyists, commercials, and sideliners, it's about 40%, and it's been that way for at least the last 5 years. And in the face of that, somehow we've actually increased the average colony count each year. I mean, that might deviate from that trend. Well, there's a lot of things that are not fantastic, though. I mean, to do that, that's a testament to the sheer workaholic nature of being a commercial beekeeper and a lot of financial risk. And I don't know that it's that stable or sustainable, especially in light of there's some things happening in the beekeeping industry right now. For example, the drought in California is really impacting the almond growers. And a lot of people might not know this, but it is the almond pollination piece that is the main thing keeping U.S. commercial beekeepers afloat. Because honey prices tend to be terrible. We got to compete with the international market where, you know, labor is really cheap and more prone to adulteration in some areas. And it would be really hard to make a living from just honey. So we have to pollinate. And the big one is almonds. You know, for example, we get about $200 a colony for almonds. And for the blueberries that we pollinate, it's $65 a colony. This kind of gives you an idea of how valuable almonds are. And right now, there's a situation where I just read there's 1.3 billion pounds of almonds sitting in a port in Oakland. Our almond growers have not been paid for last year's crop, and they're starting harvest here any day now for this year's crop. So on top of the water issue, and you know, the almond growers we work with, you know, they're considered smaller farmers. When I say 300 to 500 acres, that might not sound like a small farm to some, but there's some corporate entities that operate like 3,000 to 5,000 acres.
Right.
And these little guys, you know, for the big guys, they're happy to get a tax write-off. But for the guys we work with, that's not what they're looking for. They need to get paid for those nuts. You know how everything's hit by inflation right now? Everything's more expensive except for the one crop. The one crop that the commercial beekeepers depend on, the prices are in the toilet because there's a huge glut right now because none are being exported back to China.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah, so we're paying $7-$8 a gallon for diesel down there. And I can't charge my growers anymore. I mean, some of them are hanging on by a thread. And so the beekeeper's just taking a pay cut. I mean, everybody wants to save the bees, but the beekeeper might be the thing that's in danger here.
Oh.
So this is a message to all mead makers. Buy lots of honey, which that's kind of preaching to the choir, as they would say. And then
naturally,
eat lots of almonds.
Let's get an almond demand spike going here, like pronto. And of course, yeah, naturally, support your local beekeepers, 100%. Because small guys.
You want to know an interesting thought I've been toying with? I've heard of, you know, for gluten-free brews, people sometimes use oats. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a lot of fats in almonds and stuff that could be tricky, but I've been kicking around the idea of trying something with some almond milk in it. I don't know if it would work, but there's only one way to find out.
Yeah, it couldn't hurt to try, at least even on a small scale, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've tried making a, what do they call it, a lactomel, where you basically take, you know, when you make cheese, you have like a whole milk you start with, and you separate out the whey, the like the fat solids and stuff from like the liquid, and then that liquid you use is the base, the water for a mead. That was interesting, not necessarily good, but I would be curious to see if you could do something similar with almond milk.
Yeah, I mean, it would be lactose-free, so it might present less challenges. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd love to think
off that. I'm not sure, but it's worth a try, yeah.
Yeah, part of my mead mead education has been doing a lot of bench trials. I love to take, like, because we're beekeepers and we work for a lot of commercial growers, I can often get like a pickup truckload of free or next to free fruit just for hauling it off and sorting it. And we'll do a bench trial sometimes of like 4 to 6 different five to six gallon batches, and then do something simple like just change the yeast in each one. Otherwise, the must is the same across the board, and take lots of notes. And I've learned so much from doing that.
Oh, I can imagine. That sounds like a lot of fun and really informative too. Because I mean, when you can control, like you said, one little factor like the variety of yeast you're using or something along those lines, it can be really educational as far as like what each yeast does and how you can contribute to the final presentation of the meat that way too.
Yeah. And honestly, even having had historically, I mean, I worked as a bartender, but my best friend was a brewer at a pretty successful microbrewery. I really underestimated how much impact the yeast variety has. Like it is actually very profound. It's really surprised me. I mean, I was shocked at what a difference it made.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be a little easy to forget about that, especially when you're, you know, looking at the beer world where a lot of the stuff that we're seeing, even on the microbrewery scale, is you know, cleanly fermented ale yeast. And, you know, unless you're kind of going into the realm of like Belgians or some of the weird like Hefeweizens and things like that, or these Kveik strains, you kind of forget the yeast can throw its own character that's really interesting in there.
Yeah, it makes me wonder about some of these breweries. Like a lot of them that I know of, the business model is that they get, you know, basically a house yeast that they use in all their recipes. And I see where that would be very logistically clean and simple and, you know, streamlined operations. But knowing what I know now, I don't know if I could ever do that. Like I could see where I want this yeast for that brew and another yeast for a different brew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Even the difference between like wanting to throw one variety of yeast into like an IPA or a pale ale, something like that, versus another variety, you know, you'd want something a little bit more like a little fruity, estuary, Englishy kind of thing for a stout, for example. Yeah, I'm not sure I could do a single brand of yeast for every, or a single variety, I should say, not brand, single variety of yeast for every brew. No.
But that does add the layer of, you know, keeping track of and collecting the, I mean, unless you're rebuying for every batch, which that's usually cost prohibitive. We love to save yeast around here.
Well, and Kveik makes it so easy to strain, to save the yeast as well. I mean, you know, you can store it as a slurry. Usually if you're doing like a bracket, you need to kind of do a separation to get some of the hops, detritus and stuff out of there. But drying it is also like somehow against all odds, it looks like it shouldn't work. You know, you end up with a kind of a brownish, blackish thing that has the consistency of those like fruit leather, fruit by the foot kind of snacks that I had when I was a kid. And yet you pitch it in the yeast and 15 minutes later, it's bubbling away like, hey, yeah, back in the party.
Yeah, I was so shocked when I learned it could be done that way. It breaks every rule of microbiology I ever learned. Like, you know, I'm trying to create, you know, obviously not a sterile culture, but a living culture of one particular thing. And here we are air drying it. And I'm just thinking, I could not get away with this with the critters I was working with in the lab. Like, it would be so contaminated. but somehow it works. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, it seems to defy so many of the different, you know, constraints that I had heard about yeast so far. And, you know, you have to have a very clean lab, and you can't, you know, you have to make sure that you're hydrating it, providing hydration nutrients, and you've got to keep it within a very, you know, narrow temperature range, like 68 to 75, and this, that, and the other. And like the only one that still applies there is, well, you got to feed it some nutrient, because honey doesn't have all that much nutrient in it. That's like the only one it hasn't defied me on yet.
Yeah, and I'm a big believer in using plenty of nutrient, the right amount of nutrient. We put all of ours in up front, because these staggered nutrient additions really don't make sense when it's a 3-day ferment. But a huge believer. That was one of the things that changed my mead making game, was just understanding how much nutrient those little critters need.
Oh yeah, well, and especially when they're fermenting hot like that, I seem to use like 2 to 4 times the recommended dosage of nutrient for, you know, fermenting like a wine yeast at room temperature. Comparatively, it's ridiculous, but you know, that is, that's the little downside to fermenting fike at high temperature.
Yeah, you know, the way we do it, I mean, when I pitch it, I use the label recommendation, but I think I might be like you. And when we make our, I'm a big fan of making a vigorous starter. And it is probably 3 or 4x when we make our starters for the nutrient.
So the starter is a little bit different than I've heard a lot of people approaching the Kvike strains. I know a lot of people like to underpitch on the Kvike. Can we talk about your starters a little bit?
Sure.
How are you approaching that as far as, like, you know, quantity, size? How are you getting these guys up to, you know, the starter is ready to pitch?
Well, my old MO, which I should say still my current MO, but I did just get a very nice, gifted to me a heated magnetic stirring plate that can hold probably a 5-liter flask on it. Yet to fire that up, but can't wait. But our old MO is just, it's super simple. I usually take a little bit of the must and a dose of honey, and I'll heat it all up so it's sanitary. And then once it cools, I fill mason jars about half full. And then, it's as simple as putting it in my oven on the breadproof setting for overnight. If it's an older one, if it's like a slurry that's been stored too long, it might take 2 days to get going, but usually overnight, or if it's a fresh yeast, it's like in minutes, like you were saying, it goes really fast. But
yeah.
So in a 5-gallon batch, roughly, we're pitching anywhere between a 0.5 liter and 1 liter of starter.
Yeah, that's a really big starter for, you know, a 5-gallon batch compared to what I've heard a lot of people dosing at it. But, you know, that obviously gives you the advantage of having a pretty big colony right off the bat that just gets to work and gets it done.
Yeah, there's a lot of differing opinions out there about underpitching and overpitching and all that. And I'm not sure where this method would fall on that scale, but I have read quite a few things where it suggests the underpitching thing is a little bit of a myth. All I know is that I'm really happy when the colony I'm wanting to grow is the one that's growing it, out competing everything else. You know, we're very sanitary with our process, and we wash all of our fruit to get it sanitized. So I'm, you know, really particular about getting the target yeast going. That said, occasionally we'll have a couple times I've had a wild yeast get going that I couldn't kill and had to live with it.
Well, so one of the things, one of the reasons that I hear people talk about using like an underpitch approach is the presentationness of that yeast character, that it's, apparently it's more intense when the yeast has to do a little bit more fighting to get the colony up to speed. In your subjective experience, what's been your perception on just the yeast character you're getting with some of these quick strains that you're pitching at this amount? Do you still get a decent amount of that yeast character?
I think we get an amazing amount. I mean, that's kind of what blew my mind about those bench trials I was telling you about, just from yeast to yeast to yeast. Now, did I do a full study and like underpitch one and overpitch one, and then it would have had to been double the size or double the number of units. So I actually haven't done that work yet, but let's just say I'm super happy with the results and really impressed with how much character the yeast can impart. It actually super opened my eyes up. I mean, there's things that I thought I hated, and then a year goes by and it's like one of the best things you've ever had. It's like, it's unbelievable.
And that is one of the fun parts about the mead making process in general, is just kind of seeing how these things develop. And, you know, you do, as you learn and play with these yeasts, you figure out, oh yeah, this is good for stuff that I'm going to drink in a couple months. This is the kind of stuff I want to use for a batch that I'm going to cellar for a little while and then sit on until maybe next winter or something like that. You develop those intuitions and those kind of knowledges from experience.
Yeah, that experience is priceless. I mean, you think you know one thing, and then I've had a favorite and a least favorite, and then a year goes by and whoa, it's 180 degrees difference. Like what time did for the one you thought you didn't like, it's suddenly the best one. Yeah. I mean, I can drink fairly soon. I love doing that just because I love mead. But once I got a taste of some good aged meads, I think it's always worth having one or two of those going on in the background somewhere for that later special date.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice to have something just kind of hanging out in the background that you can crack into when the occasion happens. But, you know, your day-to-day drinking still has to take some precedent as well.
Yeah, so it's worth having some quick meads and some long meads.
All part of developing a portfolio. So let's see here. And gosh, we have been going for a little while here. As a wrap up to this one, what are, from your experience as a, you know, mead maker on this journey, what have been some of the biggest like aha moments, the most valuable things you've learned? I mean, we talked a little bit about playing with yeasts, but is there any other advice you can impart to either just getting their feet wet or looking to up their game a little bit?
Well, this might sound pretty silly and basic, but one of my biggest aha moments was learning to not fear the foam on star sand. When I first started, I would want to rinse it out, and then you just undid all your work. Like, that's very simple, but you know, having a clean vessel is key. And the other things that I think are super key are good temperature control. Whatever the temperature that the particular yeast you're working with, if you work hard to provide it what it wants, it will pay dividends big time. Like, happy yeast makes good beverages.
Absolutely. No, to some degree, we are We are less mead makers and more yeast farmers than anything else here. Just trying to keep a colony happy and doing their thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's the other thing I find, like, yeast to be almost like pets. Like, this one's fickle. This one's very playful and frisky and fast. And then you got some that are kind of in between. Like, it's almost like they have personalities. I love it.
I can see where you're coming from there. There are definitely some strains of yeast that are like, you know, the old reliable, the lab, or the golden retriever, that I know I can always get them to do what I want. And, you treat them right, they're going to do their thing. There are some, like, there are a couple breeds of dogs, to be frank, that I just don't want to deal with anymore. I've met enough of those particular breed to know that I just, you know, they're not my style. And there's a couple strains of yeast like that in my experience as well, that I'm just done with them.
Yeah, they're so picky. You're like, what? I got to hand cook your food 3 times a day?
Mm-hmm. It's like having a 2-year-old. Come on, let's go a little further. Let's go. Oh, you can do it. You can do it, big guy. And, you know, I'm not here to coddle these.
Yeah, but sometimes that coddling does pay off. Like I said before, like, I've hated some of them, just how much coddling they took, and they didn't taste that good right away. And, you know, like, that time passes, and suddenly it's stored better than everything else. Yeah, so it's important to keep an open mind. I would say that's another piece of advice I would give any aspiring beekeepers. Take good notes. Keep an open mind.
Absolutely. I think that's great advice.
Yeah. Generally speaking, my education background's in science and stuff. And I would say the only thing we really know is we don't totally know.
There's always a little further we need to discover here. Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, it has been a treat talking to you again. Just as much fun the second time around. And I hope to have you back on the show sometime again, man. This was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me again.
Absolutely. And hey, for everybody listening at home, thank you guys for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the episode. And feel free to reach out to me. You can find me on Facebook at The Mead House, or our subreddit at The Mead House. You can also just shoot me an email at info@themeadhouse.com. And hey, guys, until next time, thanks. Have a good night.
Check out oldsoulbees.com.
There you go.
All right. Good night.
Good night.